There, everybody, and welcome again to the Rugby League European Federation podcast. And this week's guest is Danny Kazanjian. Welcome, Danny. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Graham. Nice to be speaking to you.
Great. And where are you based, Danny? Where are you speaking from?
I am speaking from Marlow, which is a lovely town in Buckinghamshire. So I moved here from London in September, a few months before lockdown, which was quite welcome.
Okay, very good. So, listen, we're going to focus on your time, actually, Danny, in Lebanon. Of course, you've been involved in Rugby League for a long time. You're presently the International Rugby League Global Operations Manager. And, of course, before that, you were the Rugby League European Federation General Manager. But the bit we're actually going to look at is before that, when you started in Lebanon. And I think, rightly, we should just acknowledge the terrible explosion in Beirut this week. Did you have friends and family that were involved or impacted upon, Danny?
I've got no family out there. A lot of friends out there. Lots of associates from the rugby league community. Just catastrophic scenes. Half the city is desolated. Thankfully, all of the people that I know in the rugby league community got away unscathed. There's a lot of damage to properties and buildings, and a lot of listeners will have heard that the rebuilding cost is about 15 billion, and the injuries are up to about 4,000 or 5,000, and over 140 deaths now. So really, really tragic scenes. But the Lebanese are a very durable people. My time there, we put up with the Hariri assassination in 2005, the Israeli war in 2006, a series of assassinations orchestrated by affiliates of the Syrian government and Palestinian militant camp warfare with the Lebanese army, and Hezbollah taking over West Beirut. So my time there was replete with political upheaval, but nothing as tragic and catastrophic as this explosion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm very pleased to say that Raymond Safi, of course, who is a staff member of the European Federation, was recently in Beirut with his family, but moved out to North Lebanon. So thankfully, within minutes of the explosion, we were in contact with him and knew he was safe. So listen, Danny, just before we get into Lebanon, I always ask every guest, what's your first memory of rugby league?
I've got three distinct memories, but my first ever memory was of Des Drummond running down the wing, probably in the 80s on a Challenge Cup game. Being from North London, we didn't really get much rugby league on the TV. We used to get grandstand Challenge Cup matches. And I distinctly remember Des Drummond running down the wing. But then another major moment was seeing Mal Meninga on the 1990s Kangaroo Tour. And this was the time when you had types of players like Gareth Chilcott, Jason Leonard in the England Rugby Union team, and I was a Rugby Union supporter. And I saw Mal Meninga, and he just weren't used to body shapes like him. He was just doing up his boots on a news bulletin after training. And I just thought, wow, that is an incredible looking athlete. And then I found out he was a centre. I thought, wow, what is this rugby league then if it's got centres like that? and then the one greatest moment that really consumed my passion for rugby league is the 1991 State of Origin series. Just seeing that being played was just a different level of quote unquote rugby. The physicality of it, the speed, the dynamism was just breathtaking. Paul Hough's performance at fullback was just incredible. So they're my three memorable moments of rugby league.
So I'm just looking at something here that tells me that before you got into your Lebanon job, you were 4 years as a scuba diving instructor.
Where
in the world did you do that?
I did it in quite a few places. The Cayman Islands, Florida, Greece, Egypt for a long time. And I ended in Greece, I think, when I was 25, 26, but the main bulk of it was in Egypt and in the Cayman Islands. So, yeah, good times.
Okay. So you've established this respect and real interest in rugby league, as you just outlined, and you began to sort of move into the media and freelance writing and sport. But how did you actually get into rugby league itself as a career, as a way of making a living?
I got a friend of mine used to work for a football website, and it was a company called Sportle, and they were branching out into other sports, and they needed a rugby league publisher stroke editor, and he put my name forward, even though I was a complete Luddite, didn't have any computer experience really, and did an interview with the main sports editor, and he said he'll give me a shout, give me a shot, I should say, and they mentored me through the difficult technical bit, but that was my first job in rugby league. Then I went on to I got headhunted by another media company to run their rugby league operation in London, Rivals, but they changed their business model, and got a lot of us got let go, and that's when I had one of the first epiphanies of my life to try and start rugby league in Lebanon. So I just wanted to stay involved in the game, and I just really felt a calling to try and assist and try and contribute to rugby league.
So why Lebanon is the place to go and do it?
My mum is from Tottenham, and she worked for the United Nations, for UNRWA, the United Nations Refugee Works Association. She was based in Beirut, and my dad's Armenian, and he was raised in Lebanon. So they met and married out there. So there was a familial affiliation with Lebanon right there. And when the 2000 World Cup, the Rugby League World Cup came around, Lebanon were, of course, in it for the first time. Because of my dad's interest, and because some of the criticism that the Lebanese team were getting, we got in contact with them. And we went to meet them at Heathrow Airport. My dad organised a load of waiters from a Lebanese restaurant. And so they really made the Lebanese team welcome. They were on the same flight as the Kiwis, and the Kiwis just didn't have anyone there to welcome them. And the Lebanese had quite a good welcoming committee at Heathrow. So that made them feel really good. And I just got to know the guys involved in the national team more. And then when my own work in London ended with that particular media company, I just felt that I might contact them to see what was actually happening in Lebanon and if there was an opportunity to get involved. And that's how I actually made the decision to go out to Lebanon.
So did you go out to an actual job, position, advertised, or was it just go out there in a sort of speculative manner and try and make something happen?
Purely speculative. The omnipresent Tasbatieri plays a role in this. In 2001, the famous kangaroo tour of 2001, when they weren't going to come over because of September the 11th, they did eventually come over. Taz was with them. I had spoken to George Elias, John Elias, who were the responsible parties of the Lebanese project back then in Australia, and they said, speak to Taz. So I went along and spoke to Taz, and incidentally, that was the first ever time that the European Rugby League project was broached to me. Taz said that they were thinking about starting the European Rugby League, which would become the RLEF a year later, or 2 years later. And so I said to Taz that I'm thinking about going out there. Taz was very clear that there was no seed money to start it. And I said, I don't want that, but it is important I get your support to have a mandate from the International Federation, because people are going to question my credentials and ask who I represent and what authority I have. So that was important. And Taz was a strong ally in the project, providing that authenticity and credibility from the International Federation. But I was working at the time as a freelance football writer I was doing actually South American features. So when I went to Lebanon, I was doing two features a day for a football website on South American football.
Okay. So just what was the state of play of rugby league happening in Lebanon? As you say, they're at the World Cup, the Elias is obviously are based in Australia, and we'll come back to that connection with the Aussies. But what exactly was happening on the ground in Lebanon at that time in terms of participation?
Oh, there was nothing. After the 2000 World Cup, the Cedars went back to Lebanon, and they got a meeting with Emile Lahoud, who was the president at the time. But because all of the team exclusively were Australian Lebanese, they all had lives and jobs back in Australia. So none of them were prepared to give that up to start developing anything in Lebanon. They also had a contact with Suhail Khoury, who was the a general and president of the Lebanese Olympic Committee. And he his office was the office that gave Lebanon the mandate from the Republic of Lebanon to represent the country in the 2000 World Cup. But there was no development going on at all. I went out there for a week for a fact-finding mission at the end of 2001. And I met with there was rugby union out there. One of the misconceptions of the Lebanese Rugby League project is that it hasn't had rugby union to contest the space, the rugby space with it. But that's not true. Rugby union had been established in Lebanon for quite a while. And I met with the heads of Lebanese rugby union and they said, well, we can think about doing a joint federation. And I said, absolutely not. Rugby league has to remain as rugby league. And I was focused on just starting rugby league from scratch. And when I was out there, I met with, through a university lecturer that I got in contact with, I met with the head of the army sports and a head of a couple of university sports departments. And so they were my main contacts. I showed them match one of the 1999 tri-series, Australia, New Zealand. So they got the idea of what the game was about. And then I said, right, if I come back, we're going to start in your institutions. And they said, yes. And that was the extent of the groundwork that was done. I then went back to England. Nick Halafihi, who was an RFL employee at the time, he gave me 10 balls and 6 tackle shields. I went to Leeds Rhinos and I did 2 days of coaching with the coaches there. That was it. And with my 10 balls and 6 tackle shields and my 2 days of coaching, I went out to Lebanon in March 2002 to begin development.
So you get off the plane, you find where you're staying. What do you do next?
We started with the three universities, AUB, LAU and Balamand, and with the army. So I would coach each of those teams twice a week. So Balamand was about an hour and a half away from Beirut. So I'd drive there on a Tuesday. I still remember I'd drive there on a Tuesday and Thursday evening. And I would do the army on the afternoons and I would do AUB on a Friday night. Great way to spend your Friday night. Rugby training by the Mediterranean palm fringe training field of AUB right on the Corniche. Beautiful. And I did LAU on, I think, Mondays and Wednesdays. So we trained up for about, so I was the only coach, I was the only referee. We trained up for, I don't know how long, a few months. They were desperate to play games. I kept saying, you're not ready, you're not ready, you're not ready. Then we played a couple of trial games and they knew what they were in for with rugby league. They loved it. They loved it, the physicality of it. And then after that, we just started a league. So we had I was absolutely focused on a championship. You had to have a championship. You had to have a minimum of 4 clubs. You had to complete all your matches. So we played a championship. We played a spring championship and a winter championship. So each team played each other 3 times. So each team played 9 times in one championship and 9 times in the second championship. And the top 2 played in a final. But I was absolutely determined that every game went ahead, no forfeits at all. So we played in some shocking weather at the top of a mountain. 3 people had hypothermia and it should have been called off. But I was absolutely certain that if there was any blow to this new baby that we're creating, it would have a detrimental effect on the way that people looked at it. And because of the character of rugby league and because of the, I guess, the psychological effect that it had on the players, many of whom were from quite a high demographic and they were disillusioned with the way that Lebanon was run politically, socially, they really were protective of this project and they invested so much of their time and energy into it that we had an instant army of leaguies there.
Okay. And obviously one of the things that you would often tell others in the future who start off by themselves doing something is, get yourself some people to help you. Surround yourself with some other people. It's not just you. What did you do in that regard in terms of building up your committee and other volunteers?
Well, there's a few people who the story of Lebanese rugby league cannot be told without mentioning. So I guess the first one, the head of sport of AUB, Ghaleb Halimi, he was the first person. I was saying that when you're going to get coaches for the second season, you don't need to pay him, because I was terrified about putting people off about spending money. But he was the one who said, right, let's pay for coaches. So he was the first person that started paying for coaches in Lebanese rugby league. Another great story was Ray Safi, Ramon Safi. Because I was coaching the army, one day the head of the army rugby league said, I've got great news. We've captured an Australian at the airport. So when Ray's parents, who are 100% Lebanese, left for Australia, they emigrated to Australia, being patriots, they registered Ray as a citizen in the country. So Ray, in 2003, I think it was, or 2004, he went to clear his head in the familial land in Lebanon. And he cleared his head and he's ready to go back to Australia. But because his name was on the official roll, back then there was army compulsory service in the army, national service. So at the departure desk to go, the customs says, oh, hello, Ramon Safi, and took him straight from the airport to the officer's camp. And he had to serve. He went into prison and then he got he had to serve a year in the army as a lieutenant. And I got him as my army coach because he was from his next Canary Bulldogs Junior or something like that. And he became my coach and he's been a really close friend and confederate and a stalwart of Lebanon. He doesn't work for Lebanon Rugby League anymore. He left last year, but he was an absolutely vital person in the story of Lebanese Rugby League. Another really important person, Sami Gadabajian, who is the General Secretary of the Federation, the committee first and then the Federation. He was the head of sport of LAU. He became violently supportive of rugby league and really embittered towards rugby union. If you asked him why he didn't like rugby union, he wouldn't be able to tell you why. But he was really, really pro rugby league. And then the fourth guy, absolutely essential. This was back in 2002 when we were starting to organise the first ever Mediterranean Cup in 2000, which happened in November 2002. And part of my training at the University of Balamand that I mentioned, this Canadian guy was there called Mohamed Habous. And he said, if you need any help in Tripoli, let me know. And we had failed to get the signature to use the Olympic Stadium in Tripoli, which was the best, most suitable stadium. And so it later became known that Mohamed was extremely well connected in Tripoli. So Mohamed was an incredibly important supporter in getting the official side of stuff on track. He was our government interlocutor and he became the president of the Lebanese Rugby League Committee, which was a government appointed group. No elected officials, seven appointed committee members. And the sole purpose of the committee was to gain federation status under the law. And it did that in 2009, I think. And Mohamed was the president of the committee and was the first president of the federation. And then he resigned in 2017 or 2018 or something like that. But there's so many more, Graham, as you will know. But those guys, in terms of the governance and the intellectual power of Lebanese rugby league, were paramount.
And just you talk there about the government recognition. One of the things I always have in my mind from, at that time I was the RFL and we weren't necessarily working on projects together, but I would certainly come across you, was there was an awful lot of stages and the next level to get to in the government and get that next level of approval. Without going into every single, blow-by-blow account, just how much work did you have to put in there to get the proper recognition in respect of the government or local authorities out in Lebanon?
Massive amounts of work, and Mohamed and Ray deserve great amount of credit, plus the associates that were in our orbit, especially their orbits. Without Mohamed, Lebanon's an incredibly venal place, incredibly corrupt place. So you need to know people. If you don't know anybody, frankly speaking, you're not going to get anywhere. So Mohamed, through his contacts, he had a good link with the sports ministry. He enabled us to get that committee appointed. And then to get to the federation level, you need four clubs. And because Lebanon is so corrupt, one of the positive byproducts is that the sports law is quite strict. A lot of Lebanese law is based on French law, and the sports law, because a lot of rich people, rich politicians, try and get power in popular federations such as football and basketball, particularly, and volleyball. They would create lots of fake clubs to get a vote on the General Assembly. So to get a club in some countries in Europe, for example, it's quite easy. But in Lebanon, you have to do a lot of things. You have to have a field. You have to have a legal agreement with the field. You have to have a legal agreement with the tax office, all things like that. So to get a federation, we needed four clubs. We got four clubs registered. Getting the fields was the hardest thing because Lebanon is not a place that is replete with football fields. And then, as I say, in 2009, we were granted federation status, and that's the highest level that you can get.
So just on this journey, so you're in there in 2002, you've gone over there basically as a volunteer. How long were you still on a volunteer status and basically making your living from your sports writing?
Another major benchmark in the Lebanese rugby league story is I think it was 2005. At that point, me and Ramon Safi had a chat with each other and said, look, we've given this 3 years. We haven't got any money out of this. We've got development, but how long can we do this for? I was in, I think, just hitting 30 or 31, I think. So an important time in anybody's life. Ray was thinking the same way. And then the rugby league gods smiled on us. And within the space of 2 weeks, we got our first ever tranche of government funding. We got 25 million lira, which was $17,000, which was game changing. And then even better than that, we got Bank of Beirut contacting us saying they wanted to sponsor the local championship. And they'd seen what they'd been following us. They'd been tracking the work we'd been doing with the young. They'd been tracking the positivity around the competition. And they sponsored us for, I think, $200,000 over a 4 year period, so $50,000. And with that, we had certain obligations about getting the Bank of Beirut signage in the press. And we had a press officer at that stage who would put our competition results in all of the main newspapers. And it got to a point that one of the funny stories I remember is in one of the newspapers, I can't remember which one of the main broadsheets, you had a small picture of Cristiano Ronaldo is on a Champions League week. And then a virtually half the broadsheet pages was our little scrum half from one of our clubs, Mohamed Murtada. I still remember his name, Mohamed Murtada. And he was playing for Juni Rugby League Club in the semi-final. So it's quite funny seeing Cristiano Ronaldo dwarfed by one of the Lebanese rugby league players in the championship.
Yeah. So you talked at the start there about some of the challenges that were going on in terms of civil unrest, wars, and so on. Can you give us some of those stories about, how games were, had to go in and around, or around this sort of slightly at times, very uncertain environment, just some insights as to some of the things that maybe would cause disruption that, other countries people wouldn't think of,
Yeah, developing rugby league in Lebanon certainly has been different to a lot of countries. And Ramon Safi tells the story that several times in, I think, 2007, he would drive to training under artillery shells when Lebanese army units were shelling the refugee camps when the Palestinian militants had taken over. I remember several occasions when we were doing training for representative rugby league with the sound of artillery in the background. So we had, for 1 year, there was Hezbollah took over the whole of central Beirut with, not violently, by the way, but just peacefully. But they took over all of a main area of Beirut. So that caused particular disruption. But the important point is that a couple of players said this to me, that the purity and the positivity of the Lebanese Rugby League project at that time was so important to them, because with all of this political upheaval, they could rely on training a couple of times a week and then playing in a well-organized championship and releasing some of their pent-up emotion and anger and frustration in a positive, constructive way. And that's one of the great values of contact sport, and rugby league's a supercharged version of those contact sports. So they really valued the sanctity of the league and the project. But yeah, there were a number of times where it was, and I remember another time we were going up to representative, and it's one of the great cliches of Lebanon that it's such a party place, but it's so bedeviled by political problems. And one time we went up to representative training, and the beaches were full of people having a good time, and we overtook these army trucks of soldiers going up to fight the Palestinian militants in the camps, looking pretty morose. So yeah, and then I guess another final point I can think of is when we got back from a Liban Espoir tour to Cyprus in 2006, I was lying on my sofa in my flat the day after we got back watching CNN, and it was the day that Israel attacked Lebanon, and I went out to my balcony. I could see the plumes of smoke that were caused. I was just been watching on CNN. I could see them directly from the Lebanese airport where the IAF had bombed the airport. And that triggered a month long war, 6 week long war that I basically watched from my balcony, seeing all the anti-aircraft guns go off and some pretty massive explosions. Even though they were the other side of the city, you could still feel them all. So yeah, interesting times.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the only one that I can think of similar is in the Middle East Championships last year in Nigeria, Cameroon, 4 days on a bus to get there and 8 days to return, and twice held up at gunpoint.
Oh, incredible. Yeah. Oh, this podcast will be too short for me to tell you the number of gun-toting incidents that we've had in Lebanese rugby league. But a funny one was when the French team, after I think it was the 2004 final game against Lebanon, this car screeched. All the French team were waiting outside the stadium to get into the bus to go home, and this car screeched up, and four guys got out with Kalashnikovs, and one of the French guys saw them and legged it back into the stadium, and then it caused a streak of people running back into the stadium. And to this day I don't know who these guys with Kalashnikovs were, but we had a lot of incidents with guns in the stadium. And Romeo Monteith has got some good stories about that when you get to the Jamaican stuff as well. So
okay, right. So just, you talked there about, you know, the match with France. We're talking about the Mediterranean Cup there, are we?
Yeah.
Started in 2002 and ran That's for right. a few years. So you obviously, you know, a little bit of focus now on the national team, because, you know, it some ways you talked there about the 2000 World Cup. So just talk us through how the national team was developing at that time, maybe particularly in the Mediterranean Cup.
Yeah, well, the listeners will mostly know that the national team was the start of the project in Australia, and the national team was exclusively Australian players. We did try and integrate local Lebanese players from as early as 2002. We had four players billeted with the squad, and there's been an ever-present number of local Lebanese players with the national team. Not as many as I personally think there should have been. I understand the reasons for that, but the relationship with the national team, quote unquote, developed over time. In that, at the beginning, it was really the Elias brothers who ran it, and they would take care, because we had little capacity and little resource, so they would run it. And then as the committee and then federation got a bit more experience and a bit more confidence and a bit more capacity, then they were, the federation took more of a direct control over it. That has never been a particularly smooth relationship. It's been a relationship that endures. The relationship between the Australian Lebanese diaspora and the Lebanese Rugby League project in Lebanon has been undoubtedly a positive one, with loads of great contributors in Australia. But it's been one that's replete with tension as well.
Sure. And that's not uncommon. You know, I had a few guests we've talked about it with, and no doubt some others in the future. When does it work well? What do you think are the ingredients that make it work well?
I think it's imperative that the diaspora respects the mother country and puts ego to one side and respects that what the end game is to develop rugby league. It's not to get to a World Cup or to enjoy yourself getting to a World Cup. It's to develop rugby league. And I give credit here to many members of the Australian Lebanese community who have contributed so much. But there has to be an understanding that what is most important is developing the sport amongst local people, so it becomes an accepted part of that country's sporting landscape. If it is just a once every few years a relationship where a diaspora heavy national team flies in to perform very well, that is not how I would consider true development, and that's not what I consider to be the in the best interests of rugby league in the long term. The locals have to take ownership of the sport. They have to be the most important people in the sport for so many different reasons, and I think that's where certain countries have done it a bit better than Lebanon, I would say, and I'm culpable myself, having been involved with the Lebanese rugby league for so long. But I think that's been done brilliantly in places like Greece is a great example, where the diaspora have supported the domestic championship to the extent that they have, even though the World Cup was nowhere near them. But I think it is something that is never easy, and it does take a lot of work and understanding and communication from both sides, because there's a lot of distance in not only in geography but in rugby league competence as well. The Australians are the superior country in rugby league, and a lot of the people who are involved in the diaspora are frankly shocked when they go to the mother country and frustrated to see that the project isn't as evolved as they hoped it would be, even after a few years, because you're really swimming against the tide in a lot of these countries when it comes to rugby league development. It's a hard slog.
Okay, and where we did begin to cross over was in the 2008 World Cup, and in that Lebanon coming through and in a group with Russia and Ireland, and the key bat was the two battles, of course, with Ireland, both in draws. And particularly the final one, I think at Dewsbury.
That's right.
Lebanon needed to win. I mean, real tenterhook stuff. That, you know, you stood there watching, and you're not that, you know, you're obviously part of the Lebanon, but you're not necessarily part of the team staff. But you're desperate wanting to win, because, you know, whilst yes, it is about in the country getting some profile through the World Cup, as what happened in 2000 can start things. So yeah, what's the feelings on the sidelines when you've been part of this project, you've gone over there in 2000 as a volunteer, you've committed yourself, and the next stage is to some extent quite dependent upon how the national team does in 80 minutes of rugby?
Well, I should say that our future was never dependent on what the national team did. It would increase the profile, but unless you've got the ability to turn that increased profile into long-standing substantial results and be able to provide a better rugby league offer and environment for people on the ground, then it's a wasted opportunity. And I think that's a lesson that a lot of countries now have to grasp and make sure that they do. They are able to take full advantage of the visibility that the World Cup brings. I mean, those Ireland games were amazing. And that Darren Maroon, one of the guys that I mentioned, or one of the contributors from the Australian diaspora who've given so much, Darren was the head coach back then. And I think that was in the middle of, at the time, his record setting run of non-defeats. As a head coach, was it 13? I mean,
Darren beat Australia's record of 12 and beaten matches from 1999 to 2001.
Yeah, I mean, Darren was a great coach, and the Lebanese team, so entertaining to watch, no matter which class of national team it's been, really entertaining to watch, really fast, throw the ball around, just really skillful players, and full-blooded players, not the biggest players, but really full-blooded. And I was really upset for individuals, really, like particularly like Darren, who never managed to get Lebanon to the World Cup, but came so close on a number of different occasions. Lebanon missed out on the World Cup consecutively on points difference, and that was a really bitter pill for everyone to swallow. But But yeah, it was two cracking games.
And was there opportunities in the top team of Lebanon for domestic players to come through and be part of?
Yeah, it's difficult because, as you know, high performance coaches are all about high performance. So they want to get the best out of it. So if coaches aren't given the understanding that they are obliged by the federation to pick a certain number of locals in the squad, not necessarily the team, then you can't really blame them for picking their best players. I think strategically, it's up to the Lebanese Federation to decide how many players they want in the squad. And I take my hat off to both Greece and Italy, who have both announced that for the 2021 World Cup, they'll have 8 local players in their squad of 22 or 23, whatever it is. And that's the way forward, because you need people who are genuinely from that country to get great experiences and continue the development of the sport. If they go and get an unsavory experience because they weren't used or they felt sidelined or disrespected, then it can have a negative effect. So I don't know what the Lebanese are going to do about it for 2021, but I think they should be looking at a minimum number of local players. That Lebanon's had a representative scene since I went there in 2002. We had our first rep game in 2003 against local rep game against Oxford University Old Boys, and played annually since then. So it's a shame now that COVID and then the economic crisis and now this bomb has put football on hold in Lebanon until next year. But I'm sure they'll bounce back quickly.
Sure. So we just sort of jump back to your journey then because at this time the Rugby League European Federation is as you say, brought about in 2003 and beginning to get itself up and running and so on. And Kevin Rudd appears. So you're doing your thing in Lebanon. But you're developing a relationship with the European Federation?
Yeah, Kevin actually came to, I can't remember when Kevin took over, but he came out to one of the Med Cups to either 2003 or 2004, I can't remember. And he actually refereed and he sent off one of the Serbian guys, and he was incredibly supportive. He and Richard Lewis was also a massive supporter. Richard Lewis and Kevin were responsible for me becoming the EuroMed development manager in, I think, 2007. And I tried to present Lebanon as professionally as possible to them, and tried to represent the potential that this Middle Eastern Arabic speaking country had for the game at large. And I think they were both perspicacious enough to see that that was something that should really be followed through, and that I think I had enough of a track record, enough runs on the board, as it were, by then, for them to invest in that position, which they did. And Lebanon's always been a really close affiliate of the RLEF since the first meeting in 2003, when it was one of the founding affiliate members, because we knew that Lebanon knew that to organise the sport properly, you needed a strong transnational umbrella organisation. And through Richard and Kevin and the boards, the RLEF certainly provided that.
And so give us a bit of an idea of what EuroMed meant in terms of remit and impact on your work in Lebanon.
Well, it was dealing, as the name would suggest, with the Mediterranean countries. So back then, Italy was starting to play in its modern guise. Morocco, we went a few times to Morocco, but really the focus was on trying to develop the competitions in the region and also making sure that Lebanon was steady.
Okay, so you're sort of beginning to come to the end of your time, because I think in 2010 you became the general manager of European Federation. And when you look back at that, what now would be an 8-year journey, what do you see as the key achievements?
Well, I think because Lebanon Rugby League exists now, I think it's easy to look at it and think, right, well, there's just another rugby league country. But for me, I'm always really proud, I guess, and pleased for the sport that you've got this, the most non-traditional of non-traditional countries that plays rugby league. seeing the players discuss the tactics of the game, become just absolutely smitten with the game to the point where several of them, it's taken over their lives. I guess a bit of gallows humour that Lebanon Rugby League's now had a court case, and you're not really a real rugby league country unless you've had a rugby league court case, and that's how much it means to some people.
And that's a very positive spin on a court case, Dan.
Well, some of the clubs took the federation to court about elections, and I think the IRL recently concluded that. But it just shows how much it meant to people there. It was misguided passion. I will phrase it like that. But the immersion that so many people put into the sport and the importance that it had in their lives, that's what I'll take away from it, and that's what I'm particularly pleased of. And I must say, I take this opportunity that the story of Lebanese rugby league can't be told without the Australian diaspora, who deserve huge amounts of credit. And if you speak to some of the guys that were involved in the early stages, Graham, particularly George and John Elias, I would venture to say that they may not say kind things about me, but I would like to take this opportunity to say that I always got on well with them personally and professionally. I think they put a lot into it. Where any type of diversion of paths came was that they tended to believe that the national team should have remained as something that was controlled by Australia, whereas the people in Lebanon thought that no, this is a genuine federation now, so it has to be governed as any federation would in any sport in the world. But I want to take this opportunity to pay my respects to those two, and to say that I always got on well with them and enjoyed working with them and respected them.
And just on that, as you talk there about the kind of passion and you know, an unlikely place for rugby league, give an idea for those who've not been to Lebanon and not had the, you know, been played against them or seen them play. What is the cultural aspects that were that rugby league had to understand in Lebanon and build on?
Lebanon is not a sporting country. Like somewhere like Australia will build huge national strategies on sport as a force for good. Lebanon is not a sporting country. It doesn't have a good history of sport. It doesn't perform well in the Olympics. Its biggest sports, football and basketball, are most known for sectarianism. You get Muslim clubs, you get Christian clubs. So the biggest obstacle we had to deal with was just the lack of acceptance of sport as a force for good and as a genuine societal vehicle. Because we always said from the beginning that Lebanese Rugby League isn't a sporting project. It's a social project to try and benefit the Lebanese civil society through imparting valuable life lessons on people who played the sport, improving their discipline, improving their respect, that kind of thing. But dealing with the sectarian issue was something that we were mindful of from the very beginning. And quite frankly, it wasn't that difficult, because our attitude was there is no sectarianism in Lebanese rugby league. If we've got 17 Shiite players who are the best ones, then the national team will be 17 Shiite players. And that's the end of the story. And seeing all of these customs broken down and seeing these different demographic groups come together through rugby league was brilliant. And especially the youth, when we had the junior seeders toured Qatar, I can't remember, 2008 or something like that. And you had guys from the poorest families in Tripoli playing in teams with players from the richest families in Beirut. And it was brilliant. It was brilliant seeing those social barriers breaking down and two distinctly separate groups at the beginning of the camp. And then at the end of the tour, best friends without any barriers between them. And all sport can do that. But Lebanon and I guess some other countries in the Middle East have got that very particular sectarian divide. I mean, the Lebanese political system is based on confessionalism, 17 different official sects, each of which is relatively kept apart by being awarded a certain number of ministerial posts and that kind of thing. So that separation is baked into Lebanese societies, and breaking it down through the Rugby League project was a privilege.
Okay. Moving towards the end of your time there, what was your views on how to make sure that when you'd moved on, things continued? Because it's the ultimate trick in some ways, isn't it, about sports development? Because no one's going to be there probably forever. So what do you think is the trick to make sure that there's a legacy and the legacy is continuation for other people to build on it?
Very simple. Good governance. Making sure that there is a good governance framework that, and in Lebanon, as I mentioned before, it is embedded in the sports law system. So there's no getting around it. There's no running dodgy elections. There's no faking your accounts with the government. All of the clubs have to do very specific things to maintain their status as clubs, to maintain their voting rights as clubs. They have to do things with the tax office. They have to do things with the Ministry of Finance. They have to do things with the sports ministry. Otherwise, they lose their status, very simply. Same with the federation. The federation has obligations to the Ministry of Sport. And if it doesn't fulfill those obligations, it will lose its status. So there were enough people after my time there who were absolutely loyal to the sport, maybe didn't see eye to eye about how it should be developed, but that's not important, because what keeps it together is the legal and governance framework, and that's essential for any sport that wants to endure.
Yeah, and of course, you know, it was post your time, obviously 2013 was another disappointment and incredibly another draw, this time with Italy, that meant not qualifying. But 2017, and obviously the high point of making the quarterfinals. So there's obviously there, you know, the national team went on and again there was, you know, the participation continued. So was it hard to move on and look from afar?
No, not at all.
Or were you quite comfortable with that?
No, I was delighted not to be there anymore. And I don't mean that in an unkind way. I was just delighted to see it continue and flourish and grow and move its own way without me. That's what it must do. But one quick word on the 2011 game against Italy. What a game, one of the best games of rugby league I've seen. Steve Davis, who used to be the RLF match officials manager, he and I were fourth official timekeeper in the dugout, and it was a very hot, dusty day, and I think Lebanon came from 18-0 down and then scored to get to 18-all. And I had dusty hands and I clapped my hands to get rid of the dust before I wrote something down, and Steve was really upset that I was clapping for Lebanon. Don't clap. And I'm not clapping because the Italians were looking at me in a funny way. But no, it was great to see how things developed. They've gone through their trials after the 2017 World Cup. It's well documented that they had some severe problems, but they've come through them because the people in Lebanon believe in the Lebanese Rugby League project. The Lebanese Federation is deeply embedded in the Lebanese sports legal system, governmental system, as a federation should be. And let democracy take its course. Let people who want to take the sport in a particular direction do it through democratic and legal means, and people in the federation would embrace that. Naif, incidentally, another good guy, he's the chief executive, Naif Abi Saeed. Yep. Yep. He was at the first ever training session of Lebanese Rugby League at LAU back in 2002. So he's a guy that's really from nothing, had an almost 20-year association with the sport as a born and bred Lebanese guy. So there are many people like that, and they're the ones who will take the project forward.
And that's a fantastic, I think, finishing point, to think that there's someone now who is, you know, as you say, leading the project, was there at one of your first ever sessions. Thank you, Danny. Thanks for joining us. Hope you keep safe in Marlow, and we'll perhaps get you on further down the line back on to do the second half, which of course is in the general manager, you know, 2:10 to 2:18. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Danny.
All right, my pleasure. It was nice speaking to you.
Listen, folks, that's the end of this podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it as ever. Gaining some further insights there. We've covered a lot of countries. I dare say, yes, you could say Lebanon's not in Europe, but of course, European Federation covers an awful lot of nations, and we'll delve into some of the the further ones in coming weeks. So in the meantime, as ever, stay safe, you and your families and your communities, and we look forward to you joining us again in 2 weeks' time.